From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 1861 when the Vice President of the Confederacy, Alexander Stephens, delivered his so-called Cornerstone Speech. Stephens declared that the very founding of the Confederacy was based on the, quote, great truth that the Negro is not equal to the white man, that slavery, subordination to the superior race, is his natural and normal condition. End quote. Again, this was the Vice President of the Confederacy making the cause for the war clear. But as journalist Adam Serwer points out, Stephens would later claim that the war was not about slavery. The Confederacy was all about self-government, states' rights. And Stephens insisted that Southerners wanted what was best for everyone. Even today, in 2017, some American students are taught that the Civil War was not fought specifically about slavery, but about states' rights. It's part of the great denial that Americans sometimes have about race, and a lengthy new piece examines our history in this regard. The piece is titled The Nationalist's Delusion, a remarkable exploration conducted by journalist Adam Serwer in The Atlantic. Serwer not only takes us back to Alexander Stephens, he works throughout our country's history to find eerie parallels all the way up to the election of Donald Trump. Serwer also takes aim at one of the most common explanations for why Donald Trump won, which sounds something like this. There was too much economic anxiety. The white working class in particular was shaken up by globalism and a changing workforce. It wasn't about race, but about jobs. And maybe you feel that way too. I would urge you not only to read Adam Serwer's work, but to stay with us for this entire hour. My guest is Adam Serwer, the journalist joining us from The Atlantic's offices. And thank you so much for taking the time, Adam. How are you?
Thanks for having me. I'm doing great. Thank you.
Yeah. Are you surprised at the reaction to this piece? I mean, I've seen just about everyone of prominence talking about it in some fashion in recent days.
I am somewhat surprised at the reaction to it. I started writing this piece in the fall of 2016, and I had basically worked on it for the past year on and off. And I was actually kind of concerned that it wouldn't get the attention that it ended up getting. But it turns out people liked it, which is obviously a great feeling.
Well, in a moment, I'd like to work through some of the historic examples you do offer in this piece, because as I mentioned, you know, Alexander Stephens is a famous case in which made clear the cause of the Civil War. But there are many other examples that I want to walk through with you that I think you lay out in a way that makes this pattern really troubling but clear. So we'll get there in a second, but let's move back to some factual information first. So let's start with some data. Did the working class of this country cement Donald Trump's election?
No. I mean, I think it's pretty clear that the people making less than $50,000 a year overall voted heavily for Clinton. Now, white people making less than that did vote mostly for Donald Trump, but there's kind of an elision of working class in the conversation about Donald Trump, where we're really talking about not just the white working class, but white people in general. But it's always referred to as the white working class, while the more diverse working class in the United States, which voted for the other candidate, is sort of erased in the conversation and not discussed because it's not particularly convenient for the narrative that this, you know, what happened in 2016 was a working class rebellion that brought a man into office who spoke to very specific economic troubles.
I think that's such an important point. If we say that the working class voted a certain way, and what we actually mean is the white working class, then we need to say that because there is erasure going on. But another thing that I thought was striking that Adam's piece points out is if you look at just white voters, the biggest margin in which Trump, because Trump won every category of white voters against Hillary Clinton,
right,
but the biggest margin was not the poorest white voters. It was white people making $50,000 to $100,000. What does that tell you, Adam?
Well, I think it says that, you know, it's not just about deprivation, right? I mean, there was this sort of narrative that these people are voting out of desperation, but actually, the numbers don't really show that. Now, obviously, you know, I don't want to say that these people in the $50,000 to $100,000 category weren't suffering economically. You know, many of them were. Obviously, we just had a long recession; a lot of people's wealth was wiped out. But you know, there was an ideological frame through which they viewed their problems. And Donald Trump's solutions would not have appealed to them without that ideological frame. And we know that because when you look at voters of color who voted overwhelmingly for Hillary Clinton and whom suffered, you know, by the numbers in an even greater sense because of the recession, because of the housing crisis, and, you know, what the Fed data shows is, you know, a incredible wipeout of Black and Hispanic wealth. These voters did not react in the same way to the same economic suffering that they were feeling. And I think that tells us that what's important is not just economic suffering. Economic suffering is not sufficient, although obviously there were a lot of people across the country and still are who, you know, are struggling financially. The salient issue is, how do you view those problems? What is the ideological frame with which you understand your challenges and misfortunes? And I think when you look at that, it's hard to avoid the conclusion that Donald Trump's solutions appealed to people because they were primed to accept that their problems were the result of racial and ethnic minorities who he demonized during the campaign.
Listeners, if you want to call the program, our guest is journalist Adam Serwer, whose piece is one that we'll link in several places. We've already done that, and you ought to read it. It'll take you a while, but it is worth every word. It's The Nationalist Delusion in the pages of The Atlantic. And you can call the program 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. So let's talk history. And let's start right there in 1861 with Alexander Stevens. He tried to claim later, as your piece says, Adam, that, well, maybe he was misquoted or really he didn't mean what was often attributed to him, which is that he said the great truth that the Negro is not equal to the white man. So just remind our listeners, you know, a little bit more of that story, what he tried to later claim.
So this is, you know, one of my favorite sort of little discoveries in the piece was that Stevens, you know, he blamed the crooked media, you know, for
it's always
for
the media's fault.
Misquoting him. It's the media's fault. But, you know, Stevens, you know, his rationalization of what happened was the beginning of, you know, what historians refer to as the Lost Cause, which was, you know, essentially a great propaganda campaign by former Confederates to persuade the country that the Civil War was not actually about slavery, that half the country had not actually fought for the cause of human bondage, and that it was about something else, states' rights. Freedom as they understood it. And, you know, Stevens says, you know, my own opinion is slavery as often expressed was that the institution was not the best or could not be made the best for both races. Looking to the advancement and progress of both physically and morally, it ought to be abolished. I mean, that sounds insane. But the point of the example is to show that even the most virulent bigots in American history, you know, this man who, you know, was part of an institution that betrayed the country in defense of human chattel slavery, later said that he didn't do any such thing or those weren't his reasons. And if it's possible for him to rationalize it, it's, you know, relatively simple for someone to rationalize, you know, a comparably lesser racist act.
And so let's go through some of those examples where people did exactly that. In the Jim Crow era, the oppressors were often able to claim that they were the ones being oppressed, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is really important. And in the book that I'm citing in the piece, There Goes My Everything, is really a remarkable document. It's by Jason Sokol, and who's a historian. And it really is incredible for sort of illustrating how white Southerners viewed the civil rights movement, and they saw it, particularly the federal government's involvement in protecting Black rights, they saw it as a kind of fascism. They believed that the government was fascist and they were the ones being oppressed by the government, even though they themselves were upholding a racial caste system wherein Black people had fewer rights than white people. And I think that sort of inversion of events that as being experienced by those Southerners helps, you know, illustrate, again, these are people who are defending a racist caste system who in fact do not think of themselves as racist. And when you read the book, there are just endless examples of people saying, you know, I love Black people, and they often use a word that I'm not going to use because obviously this is a public radio program. But, you know, they say they love Black people and they don't have anything against them at all, but they just, you know, they don't want to go to school with them, or, you know, they don't want to eat with them, or, you know, and so this rationalization, which is sort of, you know, it's core to the American experience, right? I mean, our country is founded on the idea that we're all created equal, but in fact, it enshrined slavery in its constitution, obliquely, but it still did. And I think, you know, that contradiction is sort of at the root of this cognitive dissonance about racism, which is that to acknowledge racism is sort of to admit something ugly about ourselves, so we have to lie to ourselves about it.
And we see George Wallace, what he was saying in 1963 versus later in 1984. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, Wallace, obviously, you know, the interesting thing about George Wallace is that we have sort of historical record of his conversion. George Wallace started out as like an economic populist, and he lost in a Democratic primary against a segregationist. And you know, he vowed that he was not going to lose that way again. And so he became this sort of arch segregationist. And it made him a powerful political figure in Alabama for decades. And, you know, he famously declared segregation now, segregation forever. He ran for president on a segregationist platform. You know, but by the time it's 1984 and he's being interviewed for PBS's Eyes on the Prize documentary, you know, he's claiming, you know, it was not an antagonism towards black people. And that's what some people can't understand. White Southerners did not believe it was discrimination. They thought it was in the best interest of both races. And so you see, again, here's George Wallace, an avatar of state racial discrimination, a man who based his career on it, who consciously shifted from being a kind of New Dealer economic populist to a segregationist. Saying, actually, you know, that's not actually an accurate characterization of me. I'm not a racist at all. And all those people in the South who voted for me because of my segregationist platform, well, they aren't really racist either.
Alexander Stevens, Jim Crow era, George Wallace, 1990, David Duke comes along, the former Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan, and, you know, he almost wins. And interestingly, your piece points out, Adam, something that I hope you can talk about at length here with us, which is it wasn't just David Duke claiming, well, this isn't about race, it's about economic anxiety. He had some national media, the Washington Post and others, kind of going down that road with him.
Well, I think, again, you know, in the Duke case, he didn't almost win, but he had a surprisingly strong showing.
Sure,
he got 43% of the vote. And it, had it been up to white voters, he won, you know, according to the Washington Post at the time, he won 60% of the white vote. He would have won in a landslide in Louisiana if it had simply been up to white voters. And that's, you know, a really startling thing. That's 1990. That's not, you know, 1940, 1955. And black voters, of course, voted against him overwhelmingly. But there was still this narrative in the press that this was about a suffering working class and economic. They didn't use the term economic anxiety, but that was basically the explanation. Working class white people had suffered through a long recession and were just they turned to this man in their suffering. But you know, part of the problem was that when you look at his share of the vote, he actually did really well in the sort of middle class and upper middle class white suburbs of New Orleans. Which, you know, he wasn't supposed to do. And so the class picture that they had trying to paint was actually, you know, far more complicated than the one that they were peddling. But as in 2016, it offered a kind of absolution, right? It's not that these people are racist. It's that, you know, they're suffering. And so, you know, they just felt like they had no other choice. And in particular, if you go back and you look at the coverage of Duke's supporters, you know, they're saying things like, I don't think he's racist. You know, the way that I understand the Klan, you know, it's not racist. Besides, that was a long time ago. And often, you know, they'd get mad at the press. They'd say, you know, this Mr. Duke isn't racist. You're just taking things out of context. You're trying to make him look bad. And all of that, you know, obviously there are a lot of parallels to the 2016 election in terms of how the press covered it. And how the supporters themselves rationalized it, and you know the actual voting numbers as compared to the political narrative that had dominated. But the other interesting thing is that Donald Trump was paying attention to that race. You know, a couple weeks after the race, he's on CNN, he's talking to Larry King, and Larry King asks him about the David Duke race in Louisiana, and he's saying, you know, this tremendous anger down there, you know, because of the jobs and and people are just very angry. And I'll tell you, if David Duke runs for president, George H.W. Bush was president at the time. He said Donald Trump said if he runs for president, David Duke's going to get a lot of the Republican vote. And that to me was really interesting because obviously, you know, in 2016, Donald Trump denied knowing anything about David Duke. But in 1990, he was saying, look, this former KKK Grand Wizard has really cottoned on to something in terms of the his appeal and the appeal of his platform among a section of the Republican Party. And I think, you know, it's impossible to separate that particular diagnosis with the way Trump, you know, ran his campaign and the way he's been running his administration.
The interesting thing about David Duke is he has not really renounced his views on race and yet has been able to somehow convince some voters that it was just about economic anxiety. So here we come all the way now to the Trump era. And I will also say to our listeners, maybe you're thinking of a case of something being about race and then deny that it's about race. In Henrietta, when town supervisor, it's a local suburb here of Rochester, Adam, town supervisor Jack Boer in 2014 caught on audio tape complaining about what he called, quote, city cousins from Rochester coming in. He was making racist comments about people of color coming into Henrietta and came out days later and said, well, I'll take sensitivity training, but I am not a racist. I've never been a racist, you know, after saying some very clearly racist things. And so we have this history with our country. But, Adam, can you connect it then to the Trump campaign and victory?
Well, so in the sort of closing months of the Trump campaign, I spent a lot of time talking to Trump supporters and sort of asking them about Trump's remarks about Latinos and Muslims. And what I found was that these were not people, you know, these are not people who would ever go to a KKK rally or whatever, like go to a protest defending a Confederate statue or would go to a racist website. These are, you know, these are regular people. But what I found was that they, you know, when I asked them specifically about that stuff, they'd say that the media was taking Donald Trump out of context or he, you know, he didn't mean it that way. But then they'd often repeat whatever it was that Donald Trump said, you know, whether it's his generalizations about Mexican immigrants being criminals and rapists or whether it was, you know, the need to ban Muslims from the country. You know, it was like they didn't want to see his remarks as racist, but they also agreed with them. And so that ability to rationalize, you know, supporting a racist policy while not thinking of yourself as racist. In fact, these people thought of themselves as anti-racist. They were like, you know, they were telling me, I think Donald Trump loves everybody. I think he's going to be a president for everybody. You know, and this was how they rationalized pulling the lever for a guy who was essentially proposing to use the power of the state against religious and ethnic minorities, either through mass deportation, through banning Muslims from entering the country, through allowing police free rein to abuse presumably African-American suspects regardless of the circumstances. You know, and as, you know, as his presidency, we're a year into the Trump administration, you know, a lot of the sort of economic populism of Trump's campaign has really melted away. I mean, you look at this tax bill, which, you know, raises taxes and cuts government benefits for a lot of his own base while cutting taxes on the wealthiest people in the country. You know, he's you know, staffed his administration with people from Goldman Sachs. I mean, he slammed Hillary for her connections to Goldman Sachs while on the campaign trail. But the stuff that the stuff related to sort of the ethno-nationalist you know, part of his campaign, all that stuff he's actually stuck to. I mean, he's not just in a policy sense, but also in a kind of bully pulpit sense where he keeps getting in fights with black public figures. He keeps, you know, he demands that the NFL fire football players who are protesting racial discrimination and policing. And I think, you know, that the past year has sort of really clarified not just, you know, what the campaign was about, but what the administration is about, and most importantly, what Donald Trump thinks the appeal of his campaign was. I mean, if he believed that, you know, the core of his campaign was to protect things like Medicare and Medicaid, he wouldn't be cutting them, or to, you know, really get tough on China or on the wealthy, he would be doing that. But he's not. He has, however, continued to pursue an agenda based on the one that he proposed during the campaign in terms of Muslim bans, mass deportations, and, you know, refusing to police the police.
Jane Dunn, we're coming to you on the phone in just a second. And if you want to call the program, it's 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255. Or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. My guest is the journalist Adam Serwer, the author of the piece The Nationalist Delusion in the Atlantic, with this subhead: Trump supporters backed a time-honored American political tradition disavowing racism while promising to enact a broad agenda of discrimination. And he has written a piece that is, I think it's more than 10,000 words, taking us on a tour of American history and looking at these parallels and what they mean to us today. So I want to close the loop on a couple of things with Adam, and then we'll get to some of your feedback and phone calls. You can also email us, connections@wxxi.org. First of all, Adam, I know you've heard some of, you know, to the extent that there has been criticism, and I want to get some of your reaction to that. And I saw some of your reaction to someone like Damon Linker, who writes for The Week. He wrote a piece called Liberals' Clueless Crusade Against Far-Right Extremists. And he talked about several recent pieces, a couple in The Atlantic, one in The New York Times, and he mentioned you, and he says, Adam Serwer believes that tens of millions of white Americans are toxically racist, and that calling them racist loudly and repeatedly and before as wide an audience as possible is crucially important to winning the political battle against them, end quote. And Linker goes on to say, that doesn't win. That's not how you do this. You have to convince them your ideas are better, not just loudly calling people racist. What do you say to that?
I'm not entirely sure that Linker actually read the piece, because I don't give any political advice. I'm actually quite clear that the narrative that I'm telling in the story is completely politically inconvenient or politically useless, really. I mean, it's not a blueprint for a political campaign to win back power. That's not my job. But my job is to tell the truth, and I can't not say what actually happened, because that might be harmful to a political party. It would sort of defeat the point of journalism. I don't actually offer any solutions in the piece. I'm not saying if you call these people racist, it'll change. I'm just trying to, you know, tell the story of what happened in 2016 and beyond. And I think, you know, it's sort of weird to suggest that because he finds the proposition offensive, that it can't be true. But it's not, of course, not the first time we've heard that argument. And I think it's important to remember that, you know, the legalized Jim Crow, our legalized system of racial apartheid in the United States, only fell officially in 1964. The Voting Rights Act was only enacted in 1965. Most Americans didn't approve of interracial marriage until the 1990s. These people who voted for George Wallace's presidential campaigns in the 60s and 70s, these people didn't like disappear. They're still with us, and they're still voting, and they raised children, and they taught their children their values. So this idea that, you know, maybe it is offensive to a lot of people that, you know, millions of Americans could hold racist views, but it's not in any sense beyond the realm of possibility. It's sort of the reality that we live in.
And it's not just, as you say in your piece, people who vote a certain way and to support a candidate who will discriminate, who don't want to be viewed as racist. You write that, you know, a lot of liberals, a lot of progressives, a lot of members of media outlets in mainstream places probably also want to believe that Americans are, quote, better than that or not about that in many ways for different reasons, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of, you know, that's the other part of the delusion, right? I mean, the idea, the piece is called The Nationalist Delusion because it's about the particular delusion of Trump voters that they weren't supporting a racist platform. But it's also about, you know, the way that the press and even, you know, white liberals in the media sort of rationalized what was happening. And I think, again, you know, the issue here is that white Americans are the demographic majority of the United States. It's not good politics to insult them. It's not good business to insult them if you're a major media company. I mean, you don't want to, make your potential subscribers, listeners, fans angry. You also don't want to think of people you love who voted for Trump as, you know, bad people because they did that. You know, so there's just like a tremendously strong cultural, business, political incentive not to look at what happened and draw the obvious conclusion from it. And I'm not saying it's good politics. I'm not saying it's good business. And I'm not even saying that describing it accurately will work politically in terms of, you know, trying to gain back power. But I am saying it's the truth, and that should really matter.
Last question then, and we'll turn it over to our listeners, which is this. In recent weeks, we have seen, well, as you say in your piece, there have been countless either thought pieces or reexaminations, journalists going into so-called Trump country and trying to kind of peel back for answers, understand it. But a couple pop into my mind that are pretty different in recent weeks. One was from Politico, where they went to a small mining town, a steel town in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania, of course, an important swing state for Donald Trump. And the voters there essentially told the reporters a year after the election, okay, maybe the jobs aren't coming back, and maybe all those promises weren't true, but we love him anyway. We are not going to abandon him. And their single biggest complaint that the reporter heard around town was the NFL protests, the kneeling during the anthem. The piece concludes with a devastatingly disgusting line, a racial slur about NFL players. That is the big concern in that town for those folks, not whether the jobs are actually coming back. Contrast that with a piece that Ron Fournier, a longtime journalist who's now with Crain's Detroit, recently tweeted out, which I thought, again, was a well-reported piece from Wisconsin about small-town or mid-sized small-town voter anxiety, economic anxiety. This one reported in a very different way, but certainly with a lot of detail about people who had lost jobs, plants that have closed, what happens in those towns, but much more the emphasis on economic anxiety as an explanation for why it went from an Obama county to a Trump win. And I wonder if you feel like that is still valuable, that we have to understand that's part of the puzzle. Can we separate those things? Is part of the argument that there's too much emphasis on economic anxiety? How do you feel about those?
Look, I think I read both of those pieces. I thought they were very well reported. I thought they were very well written. I think, again, you know, the argument in my piece is not that there weren't a lot of people who were suffering. But to cast a ballot for Donald Trump was either to be supportive of or indifferent to the kind of state violence that he was promising to enact against people not like you. And I think ultimately, you know, your reasons for casting that ballot, you know, whatever they are, it can't be fully divorced from the consequences of doing so. And the consequences over the past year in terms of, you know, ICE raids targeting people at churches and bringing their kids to school, or you know, Jeff Sessions saying, you know, I'm not going to try to police the police, and the Civil Rights Division pulling back on enforcement of voting rights or pulling back on protections for gays and lesbians and trans people, or, you know, the Muslim ban that Donald Trump tried to enact. You know, these are things that have had, you know, real world effects on human beings. And whether you voted for Donald Trump because, you know, you wanted your taxes cut or because you really wanted to deport 11 million immigrants, undocumented immigrants in the United States, you know, the consequences are the same.
All right. Let's get our only break of the hour and then your phone calls with Adam Serwer, the journalist, the author of the piece, The Nationalist Delusion. Let's get that break and we're right back to you on the phones next on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, you heard Congressman Tom Reed on this program defending the GOP tax plan. He says it really is designed to help the middle class and the working class. But in our next hour, you're going to hear from a local town supervisor who joined a bipartisan group yesterday pushing back against it. We'll also take a look at the possible impact on grad students, higher education, and more. That's next hour on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Jane, been waiting the longest. Go ahead, Jane.
Okay, Evan. Right before the election, Hillary, I was able to see her talking about doing some sort of, I'm so upset with all that you've said, some sort of thing to a group of people, and she was bragging and trying to sell the fact that we have a great economy. We are just doing fantastic. And I think that's really, for me, I thought then, she does not get it. And I think that Donald Trump, you can explain him in some respects, and I think they're important. It's almost a primal scream. What do we have to do to make you people understand the pain out here economically? She and her friends are doing just great, with 1% of the country having 90% of everything, and it's getting worse. And I agree with a lot of people who have said that the Trump success was not so much a success for Trump as it was a revolt against the mainstream parties who insist on not getting it. And globalization works for Wall Street and the stock market. It does not work for working people, who are most of us. So, and for you to try and insinuate that someone who opposes globalization is truly a racist is just beneath you, Evan. I'm shocked.
Jane,
you're trying, yes, that's exactly what you're trying to do. You're saying it's like the pattern with the South and the Confederacy. It's no such thing. There is real pain out here, and it's not being listened to. And I'm not saying they were right to vote for Trump. I'm saying that you have to understand the pain, and policies are not being changed because it's working for the mainstream politicos and their friends. And the rest of us, as we've been advised, is just to suck it up. Thank you.
Jane, thanks for the phone call. I am simply pointing to Adam's piece as a fascinating look at parallels and a pattern in this country. And he's my guest, but it's his piece, and he can respond as he likes. Go ahead, Adam.
Well, look, I mean, I think, you know, it's absolutely true that the 1% is doing very well and that working people in America aren't doing so great. But, you know, one of the points that I make in the piece is that Donald Trump has not been helping those people at all. In fact, the Congress is about to pass, and he's going to sign a tax bill that shifts the burden, from the 99% to the 1%. He's going to be taxing his supporters. He's going to be cutting medical benefits from his supporters. But what you've seen is that, you know, and these are the people I'm talking about in the piece. His core supporters have not shifted their support from him just because he's abandoned all the economic populism of his campaign and his governing. I mean, this agenda is, you know, his economic agenda is not the one that he ran on. It's Paul Ryan's economic agenda, but it is the one that he's implementing. And so you have to ask, you know, if people wanted the wealthy to face higher taxes, if they wanted, you know, their government benefits, their health care to be paid for, as Donald Trump promised, you know, why is it that now that he's made it clear that he's not going to do any of those things, people are still sticking by him? And I think the answer is honestly really uncomfortable for people to acknowledge.
I think that's why I referenced that Politico piece in particular. And Jane, I would urge you to find that and read that. I mean, everything Adam just told you is true, that yes, there is economic pain. There is income inequality that is a significant, significant issue in this country. And no doubt a lot of what Jane expressed is true and important. But when you go back to these small towns and they say, well, maybe the jobs aren't coming, but look at those NFL players. And at least Trump's going after them, so he'll have our support. That is a significant revelation, and that happens over and over again. And so, but Jane, let me also say, I've had Matt Stoller on this program a couple of times. Matt wrote a piece, a cover story in The Atlantic, that ran just about a month before the election last year, that looks very much at what economic populism is, and Brandeis versus Bork, and so many other important issues, and we will continue to have those conversations. That's not on the back burner. It's just a question of what is part of the fabric of our country going back to the founding, and what does it say about us? What do we need to sort of reckon with? Adam's piece isn't about politics. It's about understanding history. Let's get our next call. It's Scott and Henrietta. Go ahead, Scott.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just want to say thank you for clarifying for the last caller. I have not heard either you or your guest claim that racism is an explanation in the exclusion of any economic issues or anxiety. I thought you've been quite clear on that. And to that point, my question is, you know, has the author and any of the people that he's interviewed had any conversations or been able to ask people who, per our definitions here, are clearly espousing bigoted and racist positions, but personally deny that they are doing so in any way? Have you ever been able to ask them what they would consider something as being racist or bigoted?
You know, that's actually a good question, and I did not ask them that. I was mostly focused on how they felt when they heard Trump's remarks, whether they thought they were racist, and also how they felt when the mainstream media or people in the media, commentators, liberal commentators, referred to those remarks or policies as racist. But I actually did not ask them that. That's a good question.
Do I have time for a follow-up?
Yeah, go ahead. Please go ahead.
Are you familiar with any literature or anyone who has asked that? Because I think, you know, once it's identified the way that you have, and, you know, building on the scholarship of other people, I mean, to me, that's the next question. If the entire nation, you know, being founded on slavery says, you know, we're pretty happy that we're not a racist nation, how do we identify what is racist so people can actually see it?
Well, I think, you know, in some sense, you know, one of the Trump supporters I quoted said to me, you know, I don't think he's racist because he couldn't have been successful in business if he was racist. And I think that sort of gets at the definition. A lot of people understand racism as like you're a bad person, you're some kind of monster. And so nobody wants to be racist in that sense, but they don't understand it as a question of policy, as a question of institutional or political power. And I think that that reality kind of obscures the conversation. It keeps us from being able to talk about the effects of policies. You know, instead we end up talking about the content of people's souls or what they thought they were doing or what they felt instead of, you know, what actually happens in the real world.
But if we go back, you know, a generation or two and speak to the people, you know, of Wallace's generation, as you said, who are still alive, you know, people who are clearly espousing a segregationist perspective and can come back and say, no, I love black people and they're great and I just want to not be anywhere near them. And by the way, I'm not racist. It seems to me we need to know what they think racism is so we can excise it. I'll stop belaboring the point, but thank you for your time.
Yeah, Scott, thanks for the phone call. I think it's an interesting point, Adam, because as you said, you know, there were even voters for David Duke in 1990 saying, you know, my understanding of the KKK is it wasn't always about race and it's not necessarily a racist thing. I mean, that's the Klan. People can rationalize just about anything. But here is a comment on Twitter from Cadell who says, your first caller expressed quite earnestly the frustration and suffering that so many are experiencing. Both parties have abandoned the working class and the poor, and they are prime targets for an authoritarian message. That's from Cadell. And Adam, again, I know part of what your role here is not to sort of coach politics on this or say, well, here's the roadmap to winning. But I do think Cadell is making a point that says if, for example, the Democratic Party nominates a centrist like a Hillary Clinton or something along those lines, as opposed to someone more in the Sanders camp or someone more aligned with those kind of messages, that they could lose again because, you know, racism or fear of the other is especially vulnerable when there is economic pain and hopelessness. Is there something there?
Well, like I said, I think the issue here is not that people aren't suffering. I mean, clearly people are, and I do actually think there's something to the criticism that both parties have poorly served the working and lower classes of the United States. I think that's absolutely true. I mean, I think, but I also think that, you know, as far as, you know, a Bernie Sanders type candidate could do better, I mean, maybe it's possible. I don't know. I mean, in the past, economic populism that tries to avoid the racial question has struggled. And, you know, it's sort of a, you know, when you look at the last like you look at the candidacy of, say, Bill Clinton, he ran as a centrist populist. And of course, he cut welfare. While also, you know, sending a pretty clear racial message to white America that he wasn't like those old timey liberals who were going to coddle black folks. So, I mean, you know, I'm not arguing that this is sort of an exclusive political phenomenon on one side. In fact, I think it has had a home in one party or another throughout American history. And I don't really have a solution. I don't know what the solution is. But if, you know, if we're saying that, you know, the working class, the middle class are struggling while, you know, the upper class are making out like bandits, I think that's absolutely true. But I do think that your ideological lens, that observation is mediated through an ideological lens that makes you know, it makes it so that one type of solution or another appeals to you. It makes you think that Bernie Sanders has a good idea for how to deal with that, or it makes you think Donald Trump has a good idea for how to deal with that. I think, you know, that's the real question. What principles are we using to make those choices? Not, you know, are people suffering, which I think is obviously true.
Sure. And again, I'll just remind listeners, if you missed it earlier this hour, Adam points out in the piece that working class Americans voted strongly for Hillary Clinton. White working class Americans voted for Donald Trump, not as strongly as a little more wealthy white Americans voted for Donald Trump. And even the wealthiest white Americans voted for Donald Trump. So it wasn't just this working class revolt. You know, if you actually look at the numbers, I want to read an email from a listener who identifies as a white nationalist who says, Evan, the way I read it, it's not really about the alt-right, which is explicitly nationalist and pro-white. It's about the great swath of white people that are implicitly nationalist and pro-white. I can't speak to that group very well. In my opinion, we absolutely should confront them about it so they can make a conscious decision. I think a lot of us, he's saying white nationalists, are fine with a multicultural country as long as we can still live in our own white neighborhoods and send our kids to good schools. I agree the implicitly white Trump voters have some explaining to do. I specifically do not want racial hierarchy in my country. I just gave up on all of us getting there together. Is saying that explicitly an example of this delusion that Adam is talking about? Adam?
No, I mean, sort of. Yes, I mean, I think obviously, like, separate is not equal, right? I mean, we already had this conversation. This idea that you can have like purely white enclaves and that's not, you know, an expression of disapproval for people who aren't white. I think that's nonsense. But it's not an example of the delusion in the sense that this person identifies as a white nationalist and is not deluded, maybe a little deluded about what that means, but not fully deluded about what that means. They're consciously identifying as someone who believes in the political and cultural hegemony of white people and is not afraid to say so.
Right. This was a listener who has emailed to say that he thinks Trump is an idiot, but if he builds the wall, he'll be grateful. And that that he has no problem saying so, and he simply wants more white voters to maybe reckon with how they feel. And that is uncomfortable to hear for a lot of people. But I think, I read your piece, and I wonder if you forced people to kind of grapple with that. Not everyone's going to go in that direction, certainly not, but maybe more than we want to believe.
Well, no. I mean, look, there are a lot of white Democrats who voted for Hillary Clinton. Most of the country voted for Hillary Clinton. It's not the case that, the sort of implicit nationalism of Trump's politics is sort of an invincible political force. If anything, it's more vulnerable now than it was, you know, in the 1920s or the 1950s and 60s. I think when you read what white nationalists themselves were saying about Trump and about this election, they're sort of surprisingly clear-eyed about Trump not necessarily being their guy, but in their view being good for them. And I think that bet was pretty clearly borne out after Charlottesville, when a woman was killed by someone who had rallied with the white nationalists earlier that day, and the president was describing this sort of KKK riot as being made up of very fine people. Like, I think it's unquestionable that these people feel legitimized by the president, even if they don't think that he is really one of them in the sense that they are these sort of explicit believers in the superiority of the white race.
All right, let me try to work through as many listener comments as we can in our final minutes. This is Don in East Rochester. Got to keep it tight. Go ahead, Don.
Yes, I'd just like to say that the anti-Muslim videos that came out yesterday from President Trump, put out by a neo-Nazi organization in Britain, comes just at the time, and I don't think this is any mistake, that the Senate is about to vote on a tax reduction for the wealthiest and is about to, pardon my expression, screw the middle class and the working class. I think it's no accident these racist and bigoted things happen at similar times when the wealthy are going to get the lion's share of this tax cut bill.
Don, thanks for the phone call. Adam, you want to respond to that?
I mean, look, I think you know, one of the things that I tried to do in this essay was I actually avoided a lot of the inflammatory comments that Trump made during the campaign, you know, about like the Latino judge who ruled against him. You know, because I wanted to tie it explicitly to policy. I wanted to say that this is not a question of Trump being impolitic or, you know, not being a polished politician, but actually proposing, you know, federal policies that are going to hurt people on the basis of race or religion. And I think, you know, the videos that he retweeted, I mean, one of them, he said it was a Muslim attacking, you know, a disabled person and the person wasn't actually Muslim at all, you know, from a British neo-fascist group. I mean, look, I think it's sort of unquestionable that the president holds animus towards Muslim people. I think that's reflected in policy. And I think that policy is actually a lot more important than these sort of than his remarks. But in terms of giving international sanction to a neo-fascist group in Britain, I mean, that's a very bad thing for a president to do. And it earned him a rebuke from, you know, the United States' closest ally for, you know, the past century. Like, it's you know, when you're president, it's a little different. When you make a remarker like that, or you say something like that that's you know, intolerant, it has a much greater effect than when you're just someone who's running for office.
And if you want to look at another recent remark, the president is responsible for some federal policy that relates to honoring Indian treaties, federal land versus sovereign territory, and there he is with some distinguished guests, and he has to drop the Pocahontas line. I mean, does that, you know, sort of at least line up with the idea that that is a kind of a moment that is not just sort of an ugly moment, but there's also policy that goes behind his view there?
Look, I don't know how much it's reflected in the federal government's policies towards Native tribes, but I do think, you know, it's sort of it's impossible to look at this moment where you're talking about these men who are of Native descent, whose populations were decimated by the United States, who then turned around and chose to serve the U.S. In wartime, in its time of need to defeat European fascism, and you've got Trump, you know, making Native American jokes while he's giving them a medal in front of a portrait of Andrew Jackson, who is, you know, responsible for the ethnic cleansing of Native Americans. I mean, I think it's in a symbolic way, I think it's a pretty ugly moment. I don't know that it's, you know, I don't know that it's reflected in his Native policy.
Let me close by asking you, in a way, how you closed your piece by saying that white nationalism is a con. Why do you put it that way?
I think when you look at white nationalism through American history, you look at the Confederacy, you look at the immigration scare of the 1920s, and you even look at the South during Jim Crow. What you have is a system where elites are able to use racial division to exploit the working class and poor and keep themselves very wealthy. I mean, you look at the planter class of the South, which you know, managed to send hundreds of thousands of poor white Southerners to fight for a racial caste system from which they, you know, did not benefit as much as those wealthy planters. I mean, I think ultimately it's an ideology that is designed to help the wealthiest people by manipulating people who have less power and money than them. And I think that, you know, the sooner that we realize that, the less effective those kinds of appeals are going to be.
Adam Sower is the author of The Nationalist Delusion: Trump's Supporters Back to Time-Honored American Political Tradition, Disavowing Racism While Promising to Enact a Broad Agenda of Discrimination. You can read the piece in The Atlantic, and you can find it in various places online. We've linked to it in several places. It's a long read, but I think worth your time for the history and some of the analysis that Adam did, a piece that goes back more than a year of work. And thank you for taking the time for us, Adam. I know you've been in a lot of different places, and you're in demand. We appreciate it, and I know our listeners do as
well. Oh, thank you
so
much for having me, and thank you to the guests for calling in.
You got it. Adam Sower, the journalist behind that piece. And listeners, if you didn't get through, a lot of feedback for this kind of a piece, but we will certainly continue to have conversations on these subjects coming up here. And speaking of, coming up in our next hour, we are talking about the GOP tax plan. You heard from Congressman Tom Reed defending it recently. We're going to talk to some others about Well, there are concerns about it and what it might have in store for all of us. So that's coming up next on Connections.